Bush likes familiarity and does not like change, especially in regard to key staff members he has come to trust and rely on. This has led to a close bond between Bush and a number of us senior staffers, particularly fellow Texans and people like Andy. His personal charm and approachable demeanor also make for an enjoyable working environment where people want to stick around, maybe longer than they should. It's a great personal strength of George W. Bush that he is able to inspire such loyalty. But for President Bush, it is also a potential source of weakness. Bush's discomfort with change makes it difficult for him to step back from the bonds he develops and make clear-eyed decisions about what is best. In hindsight, it's apparent that an opportunity was missed at the start of the second term to bring people with new perspectives onto the White House staff and the national security team. Instead, we saw the consolidation of an even more like-minded team within the cabinet and White House, particularly among the national security principals. There were changes, but they only increased the homogeneity of opinion among those with the president's ear. Secretary of State Colin Powell was out. Card later told me that Powell and Bush had previously agreed he would serve only until the end of the first term. By the time the transition came, Powell had reconsidered and was at least open to staying longer under certain conditions. But after meeting to discuss it, both men agreed the time for parting had come. Like much of the country, I was sorry to see Powell go. I always knew him to offer straight, unvarnished advice based on his years of experience as a military and foreign policy leader. What's more, he never hesitated to make his position clear. President Bush, however, apparently felt no continued need for Powell's moderate voice to counter the more hawkish views of Cheney and Rumsfeld. He would be replaced by the fully trusted and sometimes too accommodating Condi Rice, who was more than ready for a change from her position as National Security Advisor. That job had been fraught with enormous challenge and pressure, and more recently, growing controversy over Iraq. I could tell she was eager to start anew in another capacity, and Secretary of State was the only job she was interested in, as far as I could see. Some on the Bush team, including the president, felt that Rice would bring the State Department bureaucracy, including its cadre of Democratic loyalists, more in line with administration policy, whether they agreed with it or not. By contrast, Secretary Powell had deferred more to the career Foreign Service officers. This stance, along with his independent views, caused others in the foreign policy hierarchy to consider him something less than a complete team player. As for me, I think he exemplified what it means to be a team player. He looked out for the interest of the man he served, as well as the country to whom both had sworn allegiance, with great care and wisdom. It was a mistake not to find a way to keep him around. Condi Rice is hard to get to know. She plays her cards close to the vest, usually saving her views for private discussions with Bush. Over time, however, I was struck by how deft she is at protecting her reputation. No matter what went wrong, she was somehow able to keep her hands clean, even when the problems related to matters under her direct purview, including the WMD rationale for war in Iraq, the decision to invade Iraq, the 16 words in the State of the Union address, and post-war planning and implementation of the strategy in Iraq. Some say she should have pushed harder to heed the threat warnings and focus the White House on terrorism prior to 9/11. Although she has been the president's top foreign policy advisor and coordinator of his national security team, she largely allowed responsibility for all these matters to fall on people like former CIA Director George Tenet, Paul Bremer, and Don Rumsfeld. If, as President Bush likes to say, results really do matter, then history will likely judge her harshly as the person responsible for overseeing a number of the defining, and at least in the short term, ill-fated, policies of the Bush administration. But whatever her policy management shortcomings, Rice knew public relations well. She knew how to adapt to potential trouble, dismiss brooding problems, and come out looking like a star. Few perform better under the spotlight, glossing over mistakes with her effortless eloquence and understated flair. And in private, she complimented and reinforced Bush's instincts rather than challenging or questioning them. As far as I could tell from internal meetings and discussions, Condi invariably fell in line with Bush's thinking. If she wasn't actually shaping his thinking, she knew how to read him and how to translate his ideas, feelings, and proclivities into concrete policies. As the new Secretary of State, Rice got off to a strong start, With its public diplomacy component and its strong public relations role, it was a position that seemed well-suited for her dynamic personality, and she surrounded herself with a trusted and tested team that served her interest well. Steve Hadley moved up from his deputy position to become National Security Advisor. Low-key, even-keeled, bright, and tireless in his attention to detail, Hadley played the role of facilitator for the President's thinking and his National Security Council. He worked long hours and understood that he ultimately served the wishes of one person, President Bush. But he also made sure that every principal was fully informed and able to offer his or her full input into matters of policy so that no one was ever excluded or blindsided. Some reports later said that Andy Card had advocated a complete overhaul of the national security team, including the departure of Don Rumsfeld. It sounds credible to me, though this is something Andy would never say in public. His role as an honest broker of the policy process, he felt, demanded such discretion. In any case, the president decided Rumsfeld would stay. Rumsfeld is a strong personality, relentless in pursuing his goals, and utterly convinced that his years of government and corporate experience make him uniquely informed and the only qualified judge of his own decisions. Bush always seemed to show him great deference, sometimes too much. Keeping him in place at the start of the second term meant that defense would continue to be managed the only way Rumsfeld knew, his way. Changes were made in a few other key administration posts. Alberto Gonzalez, who had served as the White House counsel during the first term, was tapped to head the Justice Department. Al was the consummate Bush loyalist, a friend and associate from the Texas days who had doggedly served Bush's personal interest all the way into the White House. He had treated the post of White House counsel very much as that of the president's personal lawyer, working hard to find legal justifications and protections for some of the most controversial policy choices of the administration. These particularly included certain positions championed internally by Cheney and his counsel, David Addington. For example, the decision to broaden authority that would permit the use of once-forbidden interrogation tactics on terror detainees, the administration position that enemy combatants from the War on Terror were not entitled to the protections of the Geneva Convention, and the decision to use military tribunals rather than civilian courts to try terror suspects. It's easy to see why Bush, always loyal to trusted longtime friends and averse to change, would want Al in the Attorney General's spot. Harriet Myers, yet another friend from Texas, was named to take Gonzalez's place as White House counsel. But the transition would prove to be more problematic than either man anticipated. It's all right for a White House counsel to be personally dedicated to the president. It's much more questionable when the same is true of an attorney general, whose job is to impartially administer the law of the land, even when the results may be damaging to the president and his party. Because of Al's controversial past positions, his nomination to the job was only narrowly approved on a largely partisan vote. 60 senators, only 6 of them Democrats, voted in favor of the nomination, while 36 were opposed, all Democrats. The close call in the confirmation process foreshadowed what would be a troubled tenure in office. Unable to detach himself from his close association to the president and exert independence, and too closely aligned with the White House's political machinations, Al became caught up in a number of damaging controversies, including one that continues to raise suspicion over whether or not the Justice Department dismissed several U.S. attorneys for partisan reasons. Whipsawed by charges and countercharges, Al ended up resigning in August 2007, and his time as Attorney General has been widely viewed as ineffective. Another cabinet department in need of new leadership as the second term began was Homeland Security, still in its infancy and still struggling to define its identity. A vast, unwieldy agglomeration of dozens of formerly independent agencies, now bundled together under one name and with a new focus, physical threats to the American homeland, that sometimes contradicted the old mandates, Homeland Security was hampered by bureaucratic infighting, incredibly complex coordination challenges, and slumping employee morale. The department needed a leader with great people skills, administrative ability, a powerful overarching vision, and unquestioned integrity. Unfortunately, the first person President Bush selected for the job fell far short of these qualities. Bernard Carrick, a former New York City police commissioner who'd been warmly recommended for the job by Rudolph Giuliani, the former mayor. Giuliani and Carrick had a close personal relationship, not unlike that between Bush and some of his Texas loyalists. In retrospect, it was probably too close. Their friendship may have led Giuliani to overlook a series of ethical missteps that had deeply tainted Carrick's record of public service. Some of Carrick's lapses led to legal problems for him. In 2006, he pleaded guilty to 2 ethics violations and was fined for them, and in 2007, he was indicted on 16 counts of wire fraud, mail fraud, conspiracy, and lying to the IRS. He pleaded not guilty and has not yet been tried on the latter counts. After Bush nominated Carrick for Secretary of Homeland Security in December 2004, revelations about his behavior began flying. This was one episode in which the media illustrated the vital role the press can play in uncovering genuine malfeasance by public officials. Frankly, the media did a better job of vetting Bernard Carrick than the Bush administration did. Carrick was left with no choice but to resign.